Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer this hour. Several times a year, we take a look at what our high courts are doing here in Iowa, but also the U.S. Supreme Court. That is today. We're going to delve into some of the cases, the stories behind these cases, and the implications of the decisions made in the latest year, the latest term of the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us to do that, Tony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University Law School in our Des Moines studio. Tony, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
Emily Hughes is with us as well. Welcome back to her, Professor and Bauma Fellow in Law at the University of Iowa, also Associate Dean for Faculty and Academic Affairs. Emily, welcome back to you. So good to see your face.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's dive in. Tony, I think we're going to start off with a couple of cases that you are going to give us the lowdown on, and the ones that the decisions were handed down late last month with a great deal of, I guess, controversy surrounding these and implications. Let's talk about this census question census question about citizenship that is really still up in the air. Department of Commerce versus New York. Tell us about this case.
Absolutely, Ben. This case involved a 5-4 ruling authored by Chief Justice Roberts, who's a member of the conservative bloc on the court, but it was joined by 4 of the liberal justices. And in this ruling, the court held that the Trump administration may not add a citizenship question to the 2020 census unless it provides a justification for the question that is not, in the court's words, contrived. And the case arose from the U.S. Constitution, and in particular, the Enumeration Clause, which requires the federal government to conduct a census of the whole country every 10 years. And that census has been conducted since 1790. And of course, it's used to allocate members in the House of Representatives, to apportion members, and to draw electoral district lines. It's also used to allocate federal funds. Well, from beginning in 1820, the census asked respondents to identify their citizenship or place of birth. And that continued all the way into the 20th century. And then in 1960, the census questionnaire was simplified, and only a sample of the population was asked about their citizenship. And then in 2010, the questionnaire was further modified once again, and the question fell off entirely. But then, just over a year ago, the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross announced that the Commerce Department intended to add the citizenship question, but also they intended to ask it of the entire U.S. population. And he claimed that they were doing so because the Department of Justice had said they needed more data on citizen voting age population in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act. And it is absolutely true that many democracies around the country, around the world, asked the question of whether or not a respondent is a citizen. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. Census Bureau warned that asking the question here in the United States could depress response rates. And although the Census Bureau didn't identify who in particular might be depressed, the assumption was that Latinos in particular might be less likely to respond to a question that asked about citizenship. But Secretary of Commerce Ross disagreed and directed that the question be added. That led to the lawsuit. And what was interesting about the lawsuit, Ben, is that 18 states joined it, as well as many counties and cities that were afraid that they would lose funds if this question was added and all of the people who lived in those states and counties and cities weren't included in the census because some might not answer the question or would be discouraged by the question from participating in the census at all.
And when you say some, when we're talking about a nationwide, the North American continent, as far as the U.S. goes, we're talking about perhaps millions?
Oh, exactly, Ben. There are 325 million Americans. In fact, we'll probably find significantly more than that in next year's census. So if you're talking about a 5% decline in the response rate, we're talking in the neighborhood of at least 15 million people. And there are some estimates that indicate it could be even higher than that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Chief Justice John Roberts in the opinion says the rationale appears to have been contrived. What was the rationale the administration gave?
Exactly right. What the administration said is that this was the idea of the Justice Department, and that the Justice Department was worried about minority vote dilution if we didn't get an accurate count of minority voters, and the only way to get that was also to find out, hey, who's actually eligible to vote in the first place. But Chief Justice Roberts essentially said that that justification does not hold water because a record showed that this was not the Justice Department's idea. In fact, it was the Commerce Department that went to the Justice Department and said, hey, you need to send us a letter and ask us for this information. And what's more, the record indicated that the Commerce Department staffers actually wrote most of the letter. And so the record indicated that Secretary Ross intended from the basically the week he arrived in the Commerce Department in January 2017 to add the census, add the citizenship question to the census questionnaire. And in the Chief Justice's view, that meant that even though the it is constitutionally permissible for the census to include a question about citizenship, indeed for most of our history it has had that question, the Secretary has to offer an actual justification for it. It can't be one that's pretextual or that's contrived.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bottom line is the administration will have to race to come up with a better justification in time for the 2020 census.
Didn't the Trump administration a few days ago say, well, maybe we could delay the census? Because that printing date is has it arrived even? I think it wasn't it this week?
That's exactly right. That really would be historic if we were to see the census delayed. I would say this is a question that's really up in the air right now, Ben, and it's not clear what ultimately would happen. But if the census is delayed, that would have a very significant impact on the 2022 election because of the whole issue of political redistricting, which, of course, we're going to talk about in another case.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, Tony Goggin with us of Drake University's Law School, Emily Hughes as well of the University of Iowa Law School, going through some of the most significant cases decided recently before the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's go to the gerrymandering case, Tony, next, also decided at the end of last month. This involves the practice in which a party that controls a state legislature draws the voting maps to help elect its candidates. This is known as gerrymandering, and Iowa is an outlier here. Iowa is really has a different way of redistricting, doesn't it?
Ben, that's exactly right. Iowa really is a model for the nation, has been for many decades, because in Iowa, a nonpartisan government agency, the LSA, draws the legislative maps, subject to approval by the legislature, but they always have approved them. And Iowa law directs that partisan considerations may not be taken into account when the maps are drawn. And that really is in striking contrast to
which
a majority of states.
Which seems absolutely fair, we have to emphasize, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. And polls show an overwhelming majority of Americans would like to see a system like Iowa's adopted in their states.
Okay. So we have these two cases that came before the Supreme Court?
That's right. And these current constitutional controversies arose from a North Carolina redistricting plan drawn by Republicans to minimize Democratic voters' influence, and from a Maryland redistricting plan drawn by Democrats to minimize the influence of Republican voters. And the Supreme Court said, hey, there's no doubt that these plans are highly partisan. And the court pointed out that the plans indicate or the evidence showed that the Republican legislature in North Carolina was able to draw a plan that secured 10 congressional seats for Republicans and only 3 for Democrats, even though the state was quite closely divided. And in Maryland, the Democrats drew a plan that saw the Democrats win 7 congressional seats to only 1 for the Republicans. So the issue in the majority's view was not whether or not gerrymandering is a bad or good thing, but rather on whether the Constitution even permits the Supreme Court to hear partisan gerrymandering cases. And what the conservative majority said is, no, it doesn't let us hear these cases, even if a great majority of Americans oppose gerrymandering. The bottom line is we can only hear cases and controversies under Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution that are capable of resolution through the judicial process. And what the Chief Justice said in his opinion is, we can't find a legal standard under the U.S. Constitution that could be used by district court judges in determining when gerrymandering is too partisan, when the drawing of district lines by state legislatures takes politics into account too much. Mm-hmm. And so what the Chief Justice said is, this is an issue that's a political question which has got to be resolved by elected officials and by the voters. We as judges don't have tools to provide a legal resolution to these disputes.
Are you saying that that there has to be even it has to be at least a small constitutional question here? I mean, you just said that the court does not decide bad or good, but in some cases that is a factor, isn't it, Tony?
Oh, right, absolutely. If the court if a majority of the court had concluded that there was a legal standard they could develop to adjudicate partisan gerrymandering cases, then absolutely, then they would have decided whether or not North Carolina and Maryland had gone too far. And indeed, I think they chose, though, I mean, there are, the bottom line, Ben, is there are at least 40 states in the United States that do the exact same thing as Maryland and North Carolina. And so there's no doubt that they chose those two states because their gerrymanders were so extreme. Basically, the court was acknowledging, yeah, what happened in Maryland and North Carolina is terrible, but we're not the place to go to fix it because we don't have there's nothing in the Constitution we can point to say to district court judges, this is the guidelines you should apply in determining when the U.S. Constitution has been violated. One other thing about the case that was interesting, the court pointed out that the Elections Clause in Article 1 of the Constitution puts the state legislatures in charge of drawing congressional district lines, but it gives Congress sweeping authority to regulate the line drawing, which means, and Roberts pretty pointedly noted, if Congress wanted to fix this, it could just pass a law that provides a standard whereby the states have to take politics out of consideration. In fact, there's really nothing stopping Congress from using the Iowa system and just turning that into a federal standard. Mm-hmm. But that's, in the view of the conservative majority in the court, that's something up to Congress to decide whether they want to do it. The Supreme Court doesn't think the Constitution authorizes it to intervene in this controversy.
Mm-hmm. The vote here was 5-4. That's a split that we see in a number of cases. What did the dissenters say in this case?
The dissenters were really angry. This was the four liberal justices, Kagan, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg. And what they said is that, hey, we're always wading into complex issues that don't have clear express guidance from the Constitution as to how we develop a judicially manageable standard. We do that all the time. That's because our job is to be a judge. And the dissenters were also really frustrated that the court ignored all the work that has been done to develop quantitative standards. This has been done by scholars and nonpartisan people, in some cases looking at using computer modeling to show how it actually is doable to come up with really fair maps. But the conservatives in response basically said, basically you're talking about a political science issue, whereas our job is to just interpret the Constitution, and we don't see how the Constitution tells us how to pick which one of those computer-generated maps as being nonpartisan. And so I think the dissenters were just so frustrated that the court was punting this issue back to elected officials who are themselves the source of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so gerrymandering, as far as the courts go, our highest court has spoken. Gerrymandering is done as far as the U.S. courts go.
Well, except at the state level. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court last mm-hmm. year ruled that the Republican redistricting plan in Pennsylvania was a violation of the Pennsylvania state constitution.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so what's happening is challengers are moving to the state courts, and they're pretty much ignoring the U.S. Constitution, and they're focusing on the state constitutions to see if there are standards that can be cited by challengers to attack partisan gerrymanders in their states. But that means we're not going to have a sweeping resolution of this issue.
So we could have a patchwork of gerrymandering rulings in various states. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruling decision in this case has no bearing on state Supreme Court's decisions?
That's right. To the extent that the state Supreme Courts are interpreting their own constitutions, they're free mm-hmm. to interpret their constitutions any way they want as long as they don't violate the U.S. Constitution. And the court seemed to indicate that independent commissions, as California now has in Arizona, that they are constitutional. I don't know that all the conservatives on the court believe that, but Roberts' opinion seemed to think that he's okay with it, because there has been fear, especially when Kavanaugh took the court and Gorsuch, that a conservative Supreme Court might strike down independent commissions as unconstitutional on grounds that the Elections Clause identifies the state legislatures as the sole body authorized to do the redistricting, and that independent commissions are therefore unlawful. Were that to happen, Iowa would be the only safe state in the country because the LSA still has to report to the state legislature, which means Iowa's redistricting plan is safe no matter what the future holds in terms of constitutional rulings on redistricting.
Fascinating. Tony Goggin of Drake University, Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa. Emily, we want to turn to you before we go to break as we look at these most important U.S. Supreme Court rulings in the past few days, this past term. Let's talk about, have you tell us about Gamble versus the United States? Involves a term known as double jeopardy allowing two prosecutions for the same crime, right?
That's right. So the Gamble case is about whether you can be prosecuted in state court and then be prosecuted in federal court for the exact same crime.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was Gamble was pulled over by police in Mobile, Alabama for a broken headlight. And when the police were investigating the broken headlight, they smelled marijuana. So they ended up searching his car. And when they searched his car, they found a loaded 9mm handgun. So at the end of the day, he is arrested for having that handgun because he was a felon. He'd been convicted of a second-degree robbery. And in the state of Alabama, felons cannot possess firearms. So he's prosecuted in Alabama state court for having a firearm when he wasn't supposed to. He pleaded guilty and he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, all but one of those years suspended. So you think maybe that's the end of the story, but the federal prosecutors thought that was a too lenient sentence, or at least
serving actually only 1 year.
Exactly, or at least that's what the allegation is perhaps they thought it was too lenient. So they decided to go ahead and prosecute him as well in federal court for the exact same thing, for being a felon in possession of a firearm. He pleaded guilty in federal court as well, and he got 3 more years in prison. Actually, the exact term was 46 months in prison with 3 years of supervised release. So he didn't argue that he wasn't a felon in possession of a firearm. His whole issue was, is it right that I was prosecuted in state court and then turned around and prosecuted by the federal court for the exact same thing?
Right. And he came down in favor of his argument in this case. And the split was 7-2. Explain how the decision went there.
Right. So the issue is, what is the same offense under the Fifth Amendment? Because the Fifth Amendment, the double jeopardy clause, says that you can't be put twice in jeopardy for the same offense. So does the same offense mean the same facts? Like, I'm a felon in possession of a firearm, so I've been prosecuted in state court. I can't be prosecuted in federal court. The majority says an offense is defined by law. And so because the state court has different laws than the federal court, yes, you can be prosecuted in two different places.
It's not actually the crime, the alleged crime, but where the law is in the books, in the state or the federal.
Exactly. Hands. The majority says how we define offense isn't the facts about like what happened, but it's where the law is situated. And so an offense is defined by law, and because the state has their own law, the federal government has their own laws. They're two different sovereigns, and so both can prosecute you.
And it was interesting to see that the breakdown here did not follow that 5-4 split in the court that we see sometimes.
It did not.
And we had some liberal justices with some conservative justices.
Absolutely. In fact, all of the liberal justices were with Alito, who wrote the opinion, except for Ginsburg, who dissented, a very strong dissent, basically saying, if she, you know, her thought about how this should have come out is that different parts of the whole United States should not be able to prosecute a defendant the second time. So the federal government is within the United States, so that should bar it. This was responding a little bit to part of Alito's opinion talked about, you know, what if somebody is abroad and, you know, the United States has an interest in things that happen abroad. And if a foreign government prosecutes somebody, we should be able to prosecute somebody here for an offense.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ginsburg was sort of doing away with that argument by saying, I think within the United States, you should only be prosecuted once. Now, Gorsuch also dissented, and he also would have said, you know, you can't be prosecuted twice for this, but for very different reasons than Ginsburg. His went back to original meaning and intent and what the founders sort of intended when they wrote the Constitution.
They landed on the same side, but for different reasons.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing, another interesting thing about this case is that this is a decision that could affect the associates of the president, President Trump, who are accused of wrongdoing and perhaps hoping for pardons.
That's right. After this offense, people can continue to be prosecuted in state court and federal court. And so that, you know, that has ramifications for all criminal defendants going forward.
So if someone is convicted of a federal crime, they could be convicted of the same crime in a state court. The president's pardoning power only has power over federal crimes, right?
Exactly.
So that does
have implications. Another interesting implication of the decision is a concurrence by Thomas, who agreed with the rationale of Alito's decision, but wrote separately to address the doctrine of stare decisis. So in short, what that means is we have to follow prior cases unless there's a demonstrably erroneous, like somebody, we did something, the prior case was really, really wrong, and then we shouldn't have to follow it. He wrote an entire concurrence to talk about essentially his philosophy of when they should overrule prior cases. So you kind of have to wonder if that's not foreshadowing what might happen next term a little bit.
Okay. Fascinating. The three cases we've talked about, and we have more to come in our second half hour with Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa Law School, Tony Goggin of Drake University's Law School. In addition to three more cases in our second half hour, I'd like to get the views of Tony and Emily as we consider whether they're maybe more retirements on the high court. I guess there's some speculation out there. We'll hear perhaps some words to that from Tony and Emily. Also, what happens if there's a vacancy in the high court during an election year? Now, we used to know it would be filled. Just normally, right, Tony? It would be filled.
That's exactly right, Ben. Anthony Kennedy in 1988 was confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, since the 2016 episode, remember, with Mitch McConnell and Senator Chuck Grassley as the head of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate at that time, they used something called the Biden rule to avoid considering Barack Obama's last nominee to the high court. And that is why we do not have a Supreme Court justice named Merrick Garland at this time. Well, lots to talk about in the second half hour with Tony Goggin of the University of Drake University Law School and Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa. Join us with your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Open to questions about how the high court works or these specific cases we're talking about. 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Ben Kiefer, back with Tony and Emily in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa Law School, Tony Goggin of Drake University's Law School. They're walking us through some of the most significant cases in the past term of the U.S. Supreme Court. Some decisions you heard in the news handed down just within the last few days. If you have a question about how the high court works, or about these cases in general, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk, Emily, walk us through a case that involves a death row inmate in Mississippi. It involves race discrimination, and this death row inmate, his name is Curtis Flowers.
That's right. This case was just decided on June 21st, but the actual murders happened 20 years ago. So It tells you a little bit about how long it takes cases to wind their way through the courts. What happened is four people were killed at a furniture store in Winona, Mississippi. And now Winona is a small town in northern Mississippi, just between Jackson and Memphis. What happened on a July morning in 1996 was that a 16-year-old showed up at a furniture store for his second day of work. He had been hired to replace an employee who had been fired a couple of days before. So he'd shown up for a second day, and when he showed up, very sadly, he found four people had been shot. Three of them had already died. One of them was kind of hanging on for his life and died a week later. So in the end, four people were murdered. Those four people included the owner of the furniture store, a bookkeeper, and then two employees. So it didn't take long for the police to tie the murders to Curtis Flowers, who was the same employee who had been fired from the furniture store a couple of days before. Some of the evidence against Flowers included gunshot residue found on his hands a couple of hours after the murders, a bloody footprint that matched his shoe and his shoe style that he was actually wearing the same morning of the murders, a stolen gun that was stolen from his uncle's truck and that people had seen him near his uncle's car before the murders. And then that gun matched the gun that was used in the murder. So the evidence looked pretty damning against Flowers. What makes this case interesting it's all about race discrimination and how we choose jurors in cases. And by the time it got up to the United States Supreme Court and this decision came down on June 21st, Flowers had gone through six different trials.
Wow.
So that's pretty unusual as well. The six different trials were all tried by the same prosecutor. He kept getting convicted. Like the first two times, the first two trials, he was convicted, sentenced to death, and then the Mississippi Supreme Court reversed, saying that the prosecutor had committed, you know, basically egregious misconduct, that the prosecutor did things the prosecutor wasn't supposed to do, sent it back for a new trial. The exact same thing happened. He was convicted again. The Mississippi Supreme Court reversed again. On the third trial, the Mississippi Supreme Court reverses again, and this time they reverse by saying that the prosecutor, it wasn't just about misconduct anymore, it was about what the Mississippi Supreme Court said, egregious, really, racially discriminatory practices.
By this white prosecutor.
By the prosecutor. So it goes back down for another trial. Now we're on the fourth trial, and at this point, on the fourth trial, whereas before the first jury was all white, the second jury had one black juror, but the other folks were dismissed. The next one had a black juror. By the fourth and the fifth time, they actually couldn't decide. The jurors couldn't decide. And it went back for a sixth trial, and that's the one involved in this case.
And the U.S. Supreme Court deciding here that the prosecutor, who was white, violated the Constitution by what? By excluding potential black jurors.
Exactly. So the court said, in the eyes of the Constitution, one, basically, you know, juror who is dismissed improperly because of their race is one juror too many. And what they said is there was a juror who was dismissed because she was black, and the reason the prosecutor kicked her off, like said, I don't want that juror on the case, was because she was black. Now, that's not what the prosecutor said. The prosecutor gave other reasons, but the court found those reasons to be not convincing.
Okay, let's move on to our next case with Tony Gonkin, a case that involves the separation of church and state. Tony, at issue, I haven't seen this, but I haven't been to Maryland, I guess, Bladensburg, Maryland, is that how you say it?
Yes, Bladensburg.
Bladensburg, a 40-foot cross at issue here, a cross that honors soldiers from the First World War. It stands at a busy intersection. Tell us how that figures into this case.
That's exactly right, Ben. This was a 7-2 ruling in favor of the cross, basically, in favor of the cross's location on government property. And it included not only the five conservatives, but also two liberal justices in the majority, Breyer and Kagan. And they held that even though the 32-foot tall cross is, as you say, Ben, standing on public property at a busy intersection, it does not violate the Establishment Clause of the Constitution's prohibition on Congress making any law respecting an establishment of religion. And the key to the majority's ruling was the historical origins of the cross. In World War I ended in 1918, and 7 years after, in Bladensburg, local residents in the American Legion established the cross. They erected the cross to honor local U.S. Army soldiers who died in the war. And there's no controversy at the time. And then in the 1960s, a government park and planning commission acquired the cross and the land on which it sat in order to ensure that the traffic intersection was safe and to maintain the monument. And they spent about $100,000 on it and were planning to spend more when in 2012, the American Humanist Association filed suit saying, hey, you got a giant cross on public land. Mm-hmm. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with the plaintiffs and said that although this cross was designed to honor a secular purpose, so World War I sacrifices of U.S. soldiers, the fact that most people driving by it aren't going to read the monument's plaque and are just going to see it as a government endorsement of religion was, in this court's view, a clear violation of the First Amendment. But interestingly, 7 out of the 9 justices in the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed. What they held was that there were 3 things that made this cross acceptable under the First Amendment. And the first was the World War I origins of it, and that the cross, although clearly is a Christian symbol and clearly had a religious purpose, it also had a secular purpose of honoring all American troops, including non-Christian troops who served in World War I. And the justices also said that the passage of time was critical because over the years, the cross had become a symbol of Bladensburg, something that the community was very proud of. Neighboring communities always associated the cross with the entire Bladensburg community, not just Christians there. Mm-hmm. And it was also a symbol of pride in the sacrifices of all the sons and daughters from Bladensburg over the years. The court also made a very pointed observation, which was that if you purge all religious symbols from the public square, even where the religious symbols also have secular meanings, you'd have the result of really absurd outcomes, such as California has lots of cities that are named after saints, like San Francisco and San Diego. And the court pointed to that and said that it would look like if we allowed plaintiffs to be able to force California to change the names of those cities, it would really look like an unneutral act motivated by an anti-religious animus. So the court even went out of its way to essentially say that it's fine for towns to have names like Providence, Rhode Island, or Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Hmm. And the bottom line takeaway seems to be, as the court said, that when a religious symbol takes on an additional secular meaning, the passage of time, quote, gives rise to a strong presumption of constitutionality, end quote, which basically means if you've got a religious symbol there on public land that's been there for a very long time, it's probably safe after this ruling.
Fascinating. Tony Goggin on that case, American Legion versus the American Humanist Association. One more case to get to, and I want to make sure we have some time, Emily and Tony, to talk about some, have you reflect on this past term. But let's talk quickly about Mitchell versus Wisconsin. This is a drunk driving case where blood was drawn.
That's right. It's a plurality opinion that just came down on June 27th. It's out of Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And basically, it's a regular old drunk driving case until it gets up to the United States Supreme Court. The Wisconsin police received a report that Gerald Mitchell had driven away from his apartment, and the report said, "We think he's drunk." So the police went out looking for him, and they found him walking near a lake with slurred speech and difficulty walking. Mm-hmm. And his van was parked nearby. So they gave him a preliminary breath test, which is the test that the police give right there on the side of the road.
Breathalyzer.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he tested 0.24, which is 3 times the legal limit in Wisconsin. They arrested him for drunk driving, took him back to the police station where they were going to give the more sophisticated kind of in-station test. But before they could give him that, he either drifted into sleep or became unconscious. It's kind of unclear at that time which one. So they couldn't give him a breath test. Instead, they took him to the hospital and asked the hospital to draw his blood so they could figure out a better measure of how much alcohol was in his system. Mm-hmm. And so the case is about, could they do that? Could the police draw blood for the purpose of figuring out what percent of, blood alcohol was in his system when he couldn't consent to that?
Okay. And what did the court decide in this case?
Well, the court said, that's fine. And
why?
And they said it's fine because, interestingly, the plurality opinion said that it talked about exigent circumstances. Now, the bottom line is you need a warrant for a search in the United States, and there are some exceptions to when you get a warrant. Drawing blood is the kind of search that would usually need a warrant, so there has to be an exception. And the court spends its opinion talking about exigent circumstances and about how basically at the end of the day, they say where a driver can't give a breath test because the driver is unconscious, the exigent circumstances rule is almost always going to permit a blood test without a warrant. Now, that almost always is really interesting. Thomas concurred because he was a little upset about the almost always. He wanted a per se rule to just say this is fine, because there's an opening in the court's opinion to say in some very unusual circumstances it will not be okay.
Wanted to leave the door open just a bit for some exceptions.
That's right. And so, in fact, at the end of the day with this case, it's going to go back down to the trial court to decide if Mitchell's case is one of those unusual cases or not.
Okay.
Sotomayor wrote the dissent, and in her dissent, she basically says, our bottom line is you need a warrant to do searches, and if there's time, you should get a warrant. Last thing I'll say about this case is the state, the prosecutors who prosecuted this case, they actually conceded time wasn't an issue. They said this was not an exigent circumstances case. So the fact that the court decided it on a different ground than the state prosecutors had even alleged is something that Sotomayor talks about as well.
Emily Hughes with us and Tony Goggin, our legal scholars here to, in this case, go through six cases, make them give us the background, the stories, the arguments, the decisions, the rationale, and the implications of these very important U.S. Supreme Court cases. Let's do some time reflecting on the term and going to callers. David has been waiting on the line from Des Moines. David, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, my question for the panel is, there's been some discussion I've seen online about the appointees Gorsuch and Kavanaugh about how, of course, some people think they're partisan, but they did split on some decisions in this term. So were those splits kind of counter to that argument, or because of the specifics of the case, they didn't really bust that hypothesis?
Right. Okay, David, great question, because we hear so much about this 5-4 split. Tony, can I go to you to comment on David's question?
Yes, absolutely. And David's right. We now have a whole year of voting by Brett Kavanaugh and 2 years of voting by Neil Gorsuch. And what those votes show, as an analysis done by scholars at the University of Michigan and Washington University that just came out in the last couple of days, revealed is that Brett Kavanaugh is a much more moderate conservative than many anticipated. His voting record is almost identical to Chief Justice Roberts, who's the most moderate member of the court's conservative wing. And although Neil Gorsuch is definitely much more conservative than Brett Kavanaugh, Gorsuch is not as conservative as Clarence Thomas. Last year, during Gorsuch's first year on the court, his voting record was almost identical to Clarence Thomas. And Clarence Thomas is probably the most conservative justice since the 1930s. But in this last year, Gorsuch actually sided with the liberals on a couple of cases, and his voting records ended up being closer to Samuel Alito, who's conservative, quite conservative, but not as far to the right as many had thought. And it is important, though, to contextualize this by noting the U.S. Supreme Court moved to the left from the 1930s to the 1970s. And since the 1980s, the Supreme Court's moved to the right. And so when we use terms like moderate or liberal and conservative, they're a reflection of where the center of the court is right now. And the center of the court is definitely to the right of where it was 30 or 40 years ago. But within that context, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, especially Kavanaugh, is much more of a mainstream conservative than a lot of people expected when he took the bench in October.
Mm-hmm. Well, another retirement from the bench could change that or continue that swing to the more conservative side. Emily, what have you been hearing? Are we likely to hear about a retirement in the high court in the near future?
You know, there's definitely a rumor flying around that Justice Thomas is considering retiring, although he himself has said that that's not true at all and that he doesn't know where that rumor came from. I'm getting that from news reports. So it's hard to know. I mean, we'll always be the last to know. but one does wonder if a retirement's coming down the pike or not.
Right. Tony, and I assume you're reading some of the same reports. I know Emily was referencing a New York Times article there, but it'd be interesting. Of course, we have this big question of a vacancy during an election year. A few weeks ago, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell giving a green light to election year consideration of a Supreme Court nominee should a vacancy occur in 2020. He was asked somewhere the question, what would you do if there was a vacancy? And he had no problem saying, I would fill it. Right, Tony? So this sort of flies in the face of what happened in 2016 when Mitch McConnell, along with Senate Judiciary Chairman Chuck Grassley, denied Barack Obama's last nominee to the high court, refused a hearing to Merrick Garland. So what do you make of all this talk and possibility of retirement? Tony, I guess if there is no retirement, there is no controversy to be realized.
That's exactly right, Ben. Although I do think that Senator McConnell's comments reflect subtle pressure that is clearly being put on Justice Thomas to step down. I think the New York Times story really reflected that, because I think what conservatives look at is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and they see her as a cautionary example for Thomas, because Justice Ginsburg is 86, and she could have stepped down in 2014 when she was 81, and Democrats held both the Senate and the White House. But her decision to stay on has opened the possibility that if health were ultimately to force her from the court, Donald Trump would be able to replace one of the most liberal justices with, at a minimum, another Kavanaugh or Gorsuch. And that would represent a really historic shift in the court that would push it to the even further to the right in a way that would probably last for 30 years. And Thomas, on the other hand, if he stays on the court and a Democrat wins in 2020 the presidency, and if Democrats win the Senate back, you could be looking at the most conservative Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas, being replaced by a liberal, which would then reverse the direction of the court. So because of the extraordinary stakes of each of those seats, but especially Ginsburg and Thomas's seats, because they're on either end of the ideological spectrum and could be replaced by someone of the other party, I think that Thomas will face intense pressure next spring to step down, allow Trump and the Senate Republicans to replace him with somebody in their 40s, and then avoid the risk that Thomas might be another Ginsburg.
Mm-hmm. So after the next term of the Supreme Court, step down immediately after that?
That's what I think is the strong consensus among conservatives, that they'd like to see Thomas at least consider in June of 2020 to step down then.
Put some more fire in the election year with a stepping down, and then have a nomination and approval process going on through the summer leading up into the November election. Wow.
That's right, Ben. And I think most Republicans believe that the Merrick Garland episode worked to their favor in 2016, that it really helped consolidate the conservative base behind President Trump in the election. So I think they'd like to see some of the Republican strategists would like to see a replay of that next year.
Okay. And so the precedent, if there was one set by Mitch McConnell with the help of Senator Chuck Grassley, that can be erased. That's not really a precedent. That's a purely political maneuver that was played out in 2016 and would have no bearing on what might happen in 2020.
Well, I think they distinguish it by saying that in 2016 you had a Republican Senate and a Democratic president, whereas next year you'd have the both branches be held by the same party. But the problem with that was, as a historical precedent goes, Anthony Kennedy was confirmed in 1988 by a Democratic Senate, even though he's appointed by a Republican president. So that was a pretty the precedent they were setting did not have deep historical roots.
Mm-hmm. So what would explain the Biden rule that was often talked about by Senators Grassley and McConnell?
Right. They argued that what they were doing by blocking Merrick Garland's confirmation vote during the election was simply following something that Joe Biden, when he was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee back in the 1980s and early 90s, had argued, which was that if you've got a split between the White House and the Senate and there's an opening in the Supreme Court during a presidential election, you should leave it open and see who the voters want to control the Senate and the presidency, and then let the new Senate, new president, select a replacement. And that's another example. I think Biden, in a way, was sort of speaking off the cuff, and it's kind of another example of how he gets himself into trouble sometimes with those extemporaneous remarks. We've certainly seen it during the campaign. But I think the bottom line is we're just in an era of hardball politics. The Senate Republicans are playing hardball politics. The Senate Democrats would do it if they had a majority, and because everybody knows how important the U.S. Supreme Court is.
All right. Very good. We've come to the end of our hour, and you've dovetailed nicely into Politics Wednesday tomorrow, Tony. We'll have Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, our political scientists, tomorrow to delve into whatever's out there on our political landscape. I want to thank both of you, Tony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University Law School, to Emily Hughes, Professor and Bauma Fellow in Law at the University of Iowa. Emily and Tony, what a delightful hour. Thank you for explaining these very important and sometimes very difficult cases to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you, Ben, and thank you, Emily.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.